You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report, the True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley, and Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
You're back in the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm your host, Al Warren, and co-host today is Stephen Lampley.
Nice to be here.
Okay. And so Kev Thompson is off. Now, today we are covering the book called Sidetracked, and it's The Betrayal and Murder of Anna Kitchart. And our author is Richard T. Cahill, and thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about you to start. First of all, how did you get caught on this book? Like, what drew you to writing about this story?
Well, I knew the victim, Annie Kitchart. We went to high school together. She was a year ahead of me. As I noted in the introduction, we really weren't friends. She was a cool kid, and big surprise, I was a geek. But so we knew each other, but and I assume it's still the case, but definitely in those days, if you were a really cool kid, you didn't want to be seen with a not-so-cool kid, or you might lose your status, you know. But and the only time you'd see a cool kid talking to a not-so-cool kid is if they were making fun of them or trying to humiliate and stuff like that. But she never did, and she was always very nice to anybody that she talked to. And little things like that get remembered, and especially if you're a not-so-cool kid. And so, you know, I remembered that. And, you know, and then in 1988, during the summer of 88, after she was to graduate and I was done with my junior year, this murder happened, and it caught a lot of us by surprise. And it just was something that anybody really who went to high school and knew her, I think it stuck with them all these years because there are always so many unanswered questions, as there are in these types of cases.
Yeah, and now so later in your life, but so you've become a lawyer and you're working with the legal profession.
Yes.
What brought you back to actually doing the book? Like, just as it wouldn't go out of your mind, or what was it?
Well, I had written my first book, which was called Hauptman's Ladder, about the Lindbergh kidnapping. That was something I had been working on for a long time, kind of as a hobby. And I wanted to prove to myself I could write a book. And then circumstances came about where my father passed away, and I needed something to throw myself into just so I wouldn't think about it. And I threw myself into finishing that and then getting it published. So I had that published and so forth. And after about a year and a half, a lot of people say you should write another book. And I got thinking about it. And I thought, what would be something that would be interesting? And then the whole thing with Annie came back to me because, you know, I had an there were never any books written about it, and mine's the first. And it's a very interesting case. You know, it involves Al Sharpton and Alton Maddox, and it has that's not related to the famous Tawana Brawley case, but it happened in the background of it, in the shadow of it, if you will. And plus, I would have an advantage over any other author because I knew the people. The research wouldn't be as intense because I wouldn't have to research personalities of different people. I knew them all. I knew Mike Cavanaugh, the DA, and later a judge. I knew the Mike Broome, who was the city court judge at the time. I knew a lot of the police officers. I knew the victim. I didn't know the defendant other than to know of him. I knew his cousin, who had the same name. In fact, when they announced they had arrested him, I thought it was his cousin. And I remember saying to my father, there's no way his cousin was that type of guy. And then I realized I saw the age and realized it was an older cousin. But so all those things, and I felt it gave me an opportunity to tell a story that I thought deserved to be told. And as I started looking into it, I really had my desire to write the book strengthened because there have been some murders in Kingston, and there's been young people murdered, as there is in every community, unfortunately, throughout the country and perhaps the world. But Annie was largely forgotten when it came to the media. After the conviction, she was never mentioned. There was never anything, you know, like some local newspapers will say, hey, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this happened. There never really was anything, and it was as if she had been forgotten, and I just didn't think that was right. I thought she deserved to have her story told, and she shouldn't just be forgotten. I know her family certainly didn't, but I just thought it was time to write it, and I thought it would be a good book, and fortunately, Wild Blue Press, my publisher, agreed, and they agreed to publish it.
What exactly is it about the case that do you think keeps the media from talking about it, or the news in the local area saying 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Or is there something in particular you think that they stay away from it on purpose?
I can't say that I know that one way or the other.
Right.
The thing about the case was that initially it made national news because it was thought to be, because, you know, this poor young lady is found, she's bludgeoned and choked, and the letters KKK are scratched into her thighs. Immediately there's a thought of a racial motive for the crime. And with the Tawana Brawley matter, which also had a very strong racial motive, at least allegedly, and so forth, that brought it forward. And then, of course, Reverend Al Sharpton and his followers and supporters came involved, and that, of course, that shot it up to, you know, the heights. I mean, you know, say what you want about Reverend Sharpton, but he knows how to bring attention and news media to a subject.
Yeah.
He's demonstrated that he can do that and do it very well. And I don't like his tactics, but you can't argue that the results, that if he wants something published in the media, it probably is going to be.
Yeah.
And so that shot right up. And, you know, you had a time period where he was coming in and calling our area a Klan den, and that's not something people like to revisit. And then shortly thereafter, it's determined that it wasn't a racial crime and so forth. And the two families that were involved, the Cathcart family and the Dawson family, because the defendant was named Dawson, had a lot of relatives in the area. And I just think a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. For some, it was too painful. And for others, it was just like, geez, you know, we covered this thing. We played it up as a big racial thing, and it turned out not to be. And, it, you know,
yeah.
I just, you know, they say the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and so to speak, and this wasn't squeaking anymore, you know?
And so now the Brawney case was really, she, in essence, she claimed that she had been raped and that it was white supremacists, I guess. Is that kind of the rundown?
Well, the rundown was she was found, and I'm not as, my expertise is in the Cathcart case, but I do have some knowledge of Brawley because I did look into it to get a good background of it. Tawana Brawley was found in front of an apartment complex where she had previously lived. She was in a garbage bag, although some witnesses claimed they saw her climbing into it. But nonetheless, she was found in a garbage bag. Some of her hair had been cut. She had feces, what turned out to be dog feces, smeared on her. And with what appeared to be charcoal, someone had written various racial slurs that I won't repeat because I don't think it's proper manners, but had written them on her body. As the police did the investigation, there were some officers who immediately thought that it was a hoax. Others thought that there might be something to it. She contended eventually that she was attacked. I believe it was by five white people. I believe it was five. And as time went on, when Reverend Sharpton got involved and Alton Maddox and Vernon Mason, who were then attorneys, they're not anymore, at least not in the state of New York, they got involved. And eventually it was claimed that one of them was a prosecutor, an assistant district attorney named Pagonis, who later sued and victoriously for slander and libel. And one was a police officer named Christ had killed himself. He had been depressed and he killed himself. So that was immediately taken advantage of, and it was claimed that he was part of it. And so, you know, you had this, you know, this grand claim about this, these terrible things that was done in the name of racism, and you had very prominent African Americans who came out in support of her, like Bill Cosby and Mike Tyson, who was the heavyweight champion of the world, and at that time, Bill Cosby had not yet gone through the troubles he's going through, but both were respected men at the time, and they got involved and so forth. And, you know, it was, at least at the beginning, it was a rally cry to stand with this 16-year-old girl who was claiming to have been brutally assaulted and raped for nothing more than the fact that she existed as an African-American female. So, you know, it was a pretty big deal. Over time, it became clear that this wasn't what it was purported to be, and eventually the attorney general, who was appointed by Governor Mario Cuomo at that time, did a grand jury investigation and determined that it was a hoax and a fraud.
Right. Now when Anna Cathcart got killed, was it known at that time that Brawney had been fraudulently doing this, or was it not known yet?
It was the public was to turn not long before Annie was murdered. An individual who was one of the insiders with Reverend Sharpton and his supporters came out, and he announced to the world that this was being made up. It was a hoax. That he alleged that Sharpe and his supporters knew that Tawana Brawley was lying and didn't care. They were trying to make a name for themselves. Reverend Sharpe and his supporters vehemently denied that, and they went on the Richard Bay Show, if you remember that one from years ago, and a few other programs. It's been a long time, yeah. But almost 30 years. But it makes me feel old. But anyway,
I know. I do every day.
Yeah. So they went out and they vehemently denied it. So the public was, you know, heard that. So the mood was just starting to turn, and then this murder happens, and then a few days after the murder, it was revealed, because the police held it back initially, as they'll sometimes do for a good reason, when it was revealed that Annie had the letters KKK scrawled on her thighs and the letter K on her stomach, it, you know, immediately the media said to Sharpe, do you think there's an involvement? And he jumps right in along with his supporters and, you know, and starts making claims that there's a racist cult operating in the Hudson Valley, and that they're going to do their own investigation because they think it's related. You know, some people, including myself, think it was a golden opportunity for them to try to turn the subject away from some of the now beginning suspicions on the original case and try to drum things back up.
Yeah. Yeah, so it really had an effect on the case.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so let's do some of the basics of Anna Kitcart. How did it happen at the time? So what was the story?
Okay. On the very early morning of July 12th, there were two women who worked as nurses at Kingston Hospital, which is what it was called then, it's a different name now. But nonetheless, they were on their way. They parked their cars on a road called Foxhall Avenue, and they were walking to work. Now, behind Kingston Hospital in those days, there was a set of abandoned railroad tracks that ran back there. It had last been owned by a company called Conrail, but they stopped using it as train service in 1975. For the most part, the rails were still there. There was some of it ripped up, but they weren't maintaining it anymore because they didn't use it. So it had gotten overgrown with a lot of weeds and so forth, and some trees and what have you. But that area behind the hospital was off during the daylight hours, was often used as a shortcut. It was used by kids to play hooky from high school, which was across the street. But during the evening hours, it was often used as a place for bums to sleep, for drinking, you know, drugs and things like that. It was a relatively nefarious place at night. So this is approximately 6:30 in the morning. The sun is up, and as they're walking by, a man who clearly looked like a bum or a homeless man comes out of the wooded area where the tracks are, and he's clearly agitated. His name was Kiernan, and he told the two ladies that he had found something that was either, as he called it, a love doll or a body. So they said, "Well, go over to the payphone and call the police." He went to do that. They then went down and looked down. They were both nurses, and it didn't take them long to realize that it was a girl who had been murdered. She was nude except for her bra, although that had been pushed up. And she initially, I mean, she was African. She was of mixed race. She was African American. Her father was African American. Her mother was Caucasian. But she was relatively light skinned. So initially, one of the two nurses thought she might be Asian. They weren't sure. So they came out, and Kieran wasn't able to use the payphone. It was broken, which was, you know, all too common back when we had payphones. Yeah. So one of the nurses went into the hospital, and they called the police. The police come, and they seal it off. And there were a few people that had used that place, that area, to go cut through to go to work. And one of them was in the area when the police, well, actually three of them were when the police arrived. And, you know, that actually caused a problem because one of them, they weren't able to. They said, "Come here," and one took off running. The other two complied. The one who took off running got away, and he eventually gave an interview to a TV station that existed in those days, and he mentioned that he had seen the letters KKK on the legs, and eventually the police had to release that to the public because the news media would have broken it if they hadn't.
Right.
In any instance, so they found her, and they determined that she had been choked and she had been bludgeoned. Interestingly, though, their two witnesses at the eventual trial, their medical witnesses, their experts, would disagree. One said he thought she was choked first and then strangled. Or excuse me, was strangled first and then beaten, I beg your pardon. And the other one thought that the beating came first. And they both gave scientific reasons why. Well, that's a very important difference, because if you have a situation where she's choked and then beaten, a good defense attorney could say, well, there was an argument. He grabbed her, he choked her. She went unconscious and panicked, thought she was dead, and decided to make it look like a crazy person did it. And that's manslaughter. Right. You could argue it's depraved indifference murder, but likely it's manslaughter. On the other hand, if she's beaten first and then picked up after she had her face smashed and then choked, there's no way you're arguing anything other than murder. So it's two very different scenarios, and yet the two doctors or the experts disagreed as to what happened first. So it was that's another thing that makes it an interesting case. But
yeah.
The actual cause of death was listed as both strangulation and blunt force trauma to the head.
Well, but they couldn't determine, because I thought that they could tell if the body was still alive when it was being beaten. I kind of thought that, but
they said that she was alive when both happened. Okay. The question is which was first.
Right.
They were both agreed that the cuts on her stomach and her legs, that their heart was beating when it started, but one of the legs, her heart stopped beating, and so one of them was just immediately after she had died. So they had a pretty good idea of everything that was done to her before she died and after. That they could tell. But as to the order of things, the only thing they were certain of is that the KKK was likely done last, because they could see one of the legs, the heart was still pumping and one was not. But as to whether it was choked first or beaten later, they couldn't tell. I think the evidence more strongly suggests she was choked first, but
yeah,
that's just me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, and so here we go. They found the body. She's dead. What was the first kind of inclination by the cops at that time?
Well, they knew that they had the possibility of a racial motive. They also knew it could be something that was there to throw them off. They don't, in their actual original reports, initially do not suggest that they were following one at all. They went about it very methodically. They divided their team up. Of course, they had the people doing the forensics, and they had Detective Ricky Crum was in charge of the collection of evidence. And they also then sent a series of officers out to do a neighborhood canvas to see who had seen what. And they also had a group basically try to put together the last day that Annie Cathcart was alive to show where she was and what she did. And they did that pretty well, and they were just following that. They never really – they held back from the media about the KKK. The late Chief Riggins said that he had done that because he was concerned – his words, not mine – that every nut in town would be calling in if he released it. So they held it back. But their notes do not suggest that they were locked in on one theory. I mean, understand, they ended up making an arrest within a week, so they never – it wasn't like a long-term investigation where they were focused on this or that. They were in the process of gathering things when they got a solid lead, and then that led to the arrest that they made.
Okay. And so what determined them to – like, who did they arrest, and how did they get to that person?
Well, while they were doing their canvassing there was an anonymous phone call that came in that was made from a town called Port Ewan, which is a small hamlet, actually, just across the Rondeau Creek. So you're talking 5-10 minutes away. And it was from a payphone. And this person was a woman. She called it, and all she said was, "The girl that got killed behind the hospital, Jeff Dawson did it." And she hung up. So they had that name, but they didn't know for sure whether it was a crank or whatever. But they had it, and they were going to look into it. And then one of the detectives had said that they were hearing around town that somebody was telling people that "I hear Jeff Dawson did it." So they ended up tracing that rumor down within about 4 hours to a woman who lived on a road called Jansen Avenue, which was right near the murder scene. And they pressed her on it, and she eventually said that she was told that by a man named Todd Schlieb and his girlfriend. So they went and they talked to them, and they eventually found out that Todd Schlieb's girlfriend was the woman who had called the police. And what they pieced together from it was that on the day that the body was found in the afternoon, Todd Schlieb was driving down Broadway, which is another road nearby, and he saw Jeff Dawson walking along, and he called him over because they were friends, and he gave him a ride. And as he rode, he turned left onto Foxhall Avenue and went right by the area, which was the entrance to the railroad track, the old railroad tracks that I mentioned. And the police, of course, were there guarding it, you know, making sure nobody could go into the scene as they're supposed to. And he claimed, Schley claimed, that Jeff Dawson, who was in the back seat, when he saw the police, slid down sideways in the seat so he couldn't be seen. And when I asked him, what are you doing? He said, I murdered someone last night. And he also claimed that after they got out of the car, that he's, I won't use his exact language because I don't know that it's appropriate for radio, for public radio, but he said, you know that blank 80 Kithcart? I killed her. So what the police then did is they asked Todd Schley to wear a wire, and he went out and he went to go see Jeff Dawson, and they recorded him having a conversation with Dawson. And in that recording, Dawson said, he used an expression from the 1980s. He said she was bugging, which was a slang expression in those days that kind of meant she was pestering me. And I pushed her and she fell and she hit the back of her head, and that, which is somewhat inconsistent with the evidence. Not 100%, but fairly inconsistent. In any instance, he said, so you killed her? And he went, yeah. And then they, at that point, they arrested him and they brought him in and they did a lengthy interrogation. But that's how they got their attention sent to Jeff Dawson. It was a classic situation of an alleged criminal running his mouth.
Yeah. What was the atmosphere in the community then at the time? Like, was there a lot of fear? Did they think it was sort of some sort of serial killer or some sort of what was the general?
No. Well, it depended on certain things. I mean, those of us who knew Annie, we were stunned. I mean, you know, the idea that somebody would kill Annie was shocking because she was such a nice person. We, you know, some of us had known that she had been, like a lot of kids that age, had been experimenting with things. Back in the 1980s, powdered cocaine was very prominent, almost being used like pot back then. It was very common. And, you know, some of us knew that she was, you know, an occasional user. She was by no means an addict or anything like that, but she was partying it up. And she was coming to that point where a lot of teenagers do, where they have to make a decision. Am I going to keep partying it up, or am I going to grow up, get a job, and do what I have to do? By all accounts, she was getting ready to get her life together. She told people she was going to go back and get her GED. She was actually looking for a job that afternoon. So she, it looked like she had intentions of straightening things out. She never got the chance. So there was that. There was sadness there. There was some tension, you know, because of Al Sharpton coming to Kingston and making his outrageous statement. The local African-American leaders were much more tempered. They all said that, yes, there's racism. It's a big concern. But we want to wait to see more of the facts and the evidence of the case before we're going to make it, say anything definitive. And good for them. That was the intelligent way to handle it. And they turned out to be absolutely right because the facts showed something different later. Because Jeff Dawson, I didn't say this before, but Jeff Dawson is African-American. So there was not a white versus black racial aspect to him doing anything. But nonetheless, so there was that. There were some people that were concerned about, well, you know, my God, what's Sharpton doing here? There was a lot of concern that the chaos that had enveloped Poughkeepsie was going to come to Kingston. You know, but for the most part, Kingston is a community that always comes together. And they've done it over the years, and that's pretty much what they did. A lot of people rallied around the Kithcart family and allowed them their privacy, you know, and waited to see what was going to happen. And like I said, about a week afterwards is when they made the arrest. And that kind of, people were like, okay, good. They've got the guy. It's not what Sharpton is saying, you know. And it was kind of like an exhale, big exhale, big whew type of thing. But, you know.
Yeah.
But what was, going back to Jeffrey Dawson, what was his background and how did he come into, how did they come to meet at the track? How did all that take place?
Okay, well, Jeffrey Dawson's background. Jeffrey Dawson had a long criminal record, not one of violence. He had a lot of arrests and convictions for burglaries, not home burglaries, but burglaries of business. He broke into a Sears, he broke into another store, things like that. He would steal things and he would sell it for money. And he actually always, up until this time, with the exception of this crime, he always pled guilty. He never went to trial, he always pled guilty. And he was actually on parole at the time for one of the burglary charges. I forget which one exactly, but he was still on parole. So, but he never really had any significant violence in his past. He did have one arrest for assault where he punched somebody, but that got pled down even though he had the burglary charge. And no prosecutor that I know is going to plead down, you know, a felony assault charge to a misdemeanor when you got prior felonies unless there's some extenuating circumstances. So he had no real history of violence, but he was not – he was definitely not a stranger to the criminal justice system. And as far as how they got together – The belief is that they met at a bar called the Royal Grill, which was less than an eighth of a mile from the murder scene. There are plenty of witnesses when they traced Annie's movements that night. She was in and out of that place all the time, I mean, you know, throughout the evening. And she was last seen at approximately 2:30 in the morning, heading towards an alley that went, that was next towards, that was right next to the bar that led to a road called Jansen Avenue, which led to the tracks. But she was alone at the time. There was a witness that claimed that her and Jeff Dawson were together in the bar. Strangely, that witness wasn't called at trial, which leads me to believe they questioned that witness's credibility. But, or she, maybe they weren't available. That's not entirely clear. Were I the prosecutor, I would have called her if she's credible. But the belief is they met either in the bar or probably around the corner from the bar where Jansen Avenue and Foxhall Avenue meet. And they then went into, you know, the defendant would eventually admit that they did go into the area where she was found together. As to what happened back there, his version is very different than the evidence. He says that she was trying to say, let's go do something, which I do believe because every witness talking to them, I see she was asking, let's go do something, because she had gotten separated from the two friends that she was with, and most of the night she was looking to get a drink or to, you know, to hang out with them, something to do. So it makes sense. Dawson then said she kept him. He said, she said, leave me alone. He claimed he pushed her. She fell. She hit her head. And he said he panicked and he couldn't tell she had a pulse because his own pulse was going crazy. He couldn't tell. His claim is he then leaves the area, goes up to what used to be called Old City Hall. It was abandoned. It's since been refurbished, but it was abandoned. And he said he sat there for about 2 hours. And then he came back just to check on her because he was concerned. And she said at that point, somebody else must have come along because she had been stripped and her clothes were in a pile. And he said he then took the clothes and he got blood on his shirt, so he took his own shirt off, and he dumped the clothes in an alley where they were later found. You know, considering it was pitch black back there, it's really questionable, the idea that somebody just happened to come along, be able to see her on the ground, because it was so dark, if you didn't know she was there, you probably wouldn't have seen her, and say, here's this person laying here. I know. I'll kill her and take her clothes. It didn't make any sense.
Yeah. I do it all the time.
You know, it made no sense. Now, of course, at the trial, that tape was never played, which to me was a mistake, and I outlined this in the book. I think what Mike Cavanaugh was doing, and Mike's a good prosecutor, and he went on to become a judge, and I had a lot of respect for Mike. I think he presumed the defendant was going to testify, because most people thought that he was going to try to say, I didn't intend to kill her, and try to get a manslaughter as opposed to murder. I mean, the most you could have done on a manslaughter in New York in those days was 15 years. Murder was 25 to life, and he might not get out at all. So I think he held it back, hoping he'd testify, and then he could use it to impeach his credibility. And then when he didn't testify, he couldn't put it in evidence. That's my guess. That'd be the only sound strategy I can think of to not play the tape. I would have done so, but that's just me. But another strange twist in the case.
yeah, several. How was it then when he got arrested? So how did they try him? What was the best evidence against him?
Well, the prosecutor probably would tell you that the best evidence was they brought in a dentist who took molds of his teeth. They had found a bruise on Annie's shoulder that they believed was a bite mark. And this expert testified that he felt that the bite mark was made by the defendant and was consistent with the dental mold that they got from the defendant. I'm not convinced that that's that great of evidence because during cross-examination, he said, well, he was pointed out and said, this doesn't match. He says, yeah, well, it looks like what happened was he bit her and then she moved away and he re-bit her a second time, so it looks like two sets of teeth, but it's really one. Also, as I noted in my book, that type of testimony, of expert testimony of dental impressions for a bite mark on a corpse has come under serious attack in a lot of cases. And there are several cases, a couple of them I outline in my book, where DNA evidence, when that came along, was able to prove that a person who was convicted didn't commit the crime, even though experts said it was his bite mark. So I don't think personally much of bite mark evidence, but I think the prosecutor would have said that was their strongest evidence. The strongest evidence that I think they had, they didn't use. I think the audio tape of Dawson's statement to the police is the strongest evidence, because he puts himself on the tracks with her at the time that she was killed, and he tells a story that is too fantastic to believe, and that is contradicted by the evidence. I mean, I think that in and of itself, his statement puts him on the line for manslaughter alone, and if it's not found credible, and I don't think it would have been, it locks him into the murder, because it's so fantastic to believe that somebody else came along and completed the murder. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, today, if this case had happened today, I think the evidence would have been much, much stronger, because the forensics are so much better. I mean, they found blood on a variety of things. They actually, but a lot of it couldn't even be typed. I mean, today they could do DNA with a drop of blood. They couldn't back then. And DNA was just starting, and it was rarely used at the time. And, you know, there were still legal challenges to be made as to whether it would be allowed. But, I mean, they had enough blood that, because they found, they did find a pair of jeans when they did a search of the defendant's home with a warrant, and they found a speck of blood on the jeans. And they claimed that, they tried to claim that that showed he was there, but they couldn't even type the blood to tell you if it was Annie Kithcart's blood or if it was Dawson's or what have you. Today, if they did a DNA and they found a dot of her blood on his jeans, case closed. It's over.
Right.
You know, well, there's no other way to explain it.
Do they save that, and can they go back to something like this?
I don't know if they've saved it. Probably not, because all the appeals are done, so there's no chance of a retrial. They might have saved it, but at this point, there's no reason to, because they got a conviction. He was convicted. He was sentenced to 25 to life. Interestingly enough, about a month before my book was to be released, he got parole. And he moved, and he came back to the Kingston area. So here I am, a month later, putting out a book that says this guy did it, and he's released on parole in my hometown. Talk about Murphy's Law.
Yeah, yeah. You better advertise your address.
A buddy of mine said you better get your pistol permit.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
I don't think he's going to do anything. If anything, if he was going to go after anybody, it would be his friend Tosh Lee, who wore the wire. That's what. Got him locked up. Not me writing about it almost 30 years later.
Yeah.
And like I said, he doesn't have a history of violence, and I don't think he intended to kill her. I think he did kill her, but I don't think it was his intent.
Right.
But, you know, I don't actually believe he's going to kill her.
Yeah.
I hope not, but I don't think so.
No. Well, you know, so how was the reaction when your book came out in the community? Do you, and even researching, and if you talk to people, I guess you knew a lot of them, but...
Mm-hmm.
Were people okay with it? Like, were they kind of helpful and into it, or sometimes not? Or how did you find it?
A lot of it depended on how well they knew me, because, you know, the immediate reaction is, oh my God, what are you going to do with this? Because she was found naked with her head bashed, part of her head bashed in, and the immediate reaction was, oh my God, are you going to write a book, you know, like an Inquirer or World Weekly News kind of book where, you know, you have these horrible pictures out there, you know?
Yeah.
And, the prosecutor who was in charge of what we call FOIL, or Freedom of Information Law requests, asked me about it because there was some questions of what she was going to allow me to see from the district attorney's file. And I told her, I said, look, I give you my word as an attorney and as a gentleman, I have no intention of using any photographs of her at the crime scene, none. I might use pictures from the crime scene, like the entrance, so people can see what it looked like, and maybe some of the physical evidence it's found, but I said, I gave you my word, I will not use them. I said, I don't even want to have to look at them. That's not the way I'd like to remember Annie, and it was very difficult seeing them. But I needed to look at them to get a feel for the crime itself. If I'm going to write about the crime, I have to see everything to really, in my mind, have a picture of what transpired.
Yeah.
But I was looking forward to that. It was a very tough day that day when I saw them. But I didn't use them. Most of the pictures I used came from the Daily Freeman, the local newspaper. I'm very indebted to that. It was pictures that their reporters took, you know, of some proceedings in court at the time. They got a picture of Jeff Dawson's reaction when he was convicted, which is a great photograph. It really is. And they got some pictures of Al Sharpton and his supporters and a lot of the people, so I could put faces to names. But most people who knew me knew, you know, the type of person I am and the way I was going to write it, that I wasn't going to do anything to disrespect Annie. She got hit pretty hard in the media because, first off, and this is where the title comes from, by the way, sidetracked. Some people think, well, she was found by the side of the track. No, that's not the title. Reason for the title. The reason for the title is, the investigation gets sidetracked with all of this stuff from Al Sharpton, and then you get an allegation that the guy who found her, Kiernan, he gets arrested and gets accused of orally desecrating the corpse in a sexual manner. I won't go into details of what it is, but you get the idea.
Right.
And that comes on the newspaper. That, you know, that disgusting allegation. And meanwhile, everything about Annie herself is getting knocked out of the paper with all this terrible stuff. And there were a few articles, but largely all the articles you would see that talked about her, or, you know, that would give you all the memories, they kind of got blown off the front page. And so she gets sidetracked. And then her family had to secretly hold the funeral several hours before it was announced it was going to be, because they didn't want the media there sticking a microphone in their face. Well, how do you feel? Well, how the hell do you think they feel?
Yeah.
You know, so they got sidetracked in their efforts to mourn her. And her friends who wanted to go to the funeral, and I was one of them, we got sidetracked because we didn't know, because they weren't making it public. And I understood what they did. And so, you know, she had the investigation sidetracked. Her whole life got sidetracked by being murdered. And I just thought it fit. I mean, and it goes into also why I wrote the book. I thought she deserved to have her story told. And they also tried to play her up as being some kind of a drug addict, and she was not. Did she experiment with cocaine? Yeah. So did a lot of 19-year-old kids in the 1980s. It doesn't make them drug addicts or bad people.
Yeah.
And she wasn't a bad person. Everybody that knew her liked her.
Well, I guess it sells better, right? I mean, if you have some sort of a controversy like that, you can sell it better. I don't know.
I suppose.
You know, it's the same as, like you said, when the media comes out and says, well, how do you feel? Well, yeah, it's like the stupidest question. You know, they get someone in the middle of a tornado or a hurricane after everything's ruined. Or, how does it feel? Well,
well, let's have your house destroyed, and then you'll know.
it's just one of the questions I could never understand. It's just a reaction thing. So he was surprised that he got convicted then?
No, I don't think so, because he actually, during the trial, one of the things I found was in the district attorney's file, they found him unconscious in his cell, and they thought that during the trial, and they thought that he tried to commit suicide. So they brought in a social worker and a psychiatrist to meet with him to make sure he wasn't a risk, and they put him on suicide watch just to be safe. And some of those notes survive, and those notes indicate that he made statements about how he's on trial for murder and it's going really badly, and he didn't like his attorney and he thought he was in real trouble, and that he was a multi-time, he'd been convicted of multiple felonies, so he figured the judge wasn't going to show any mercy. So that suggests that, you know, he had a pretty good idea that he was in big trouble.
Yeah. Wow. And so he appealed, of course, as normal, and he spent his, you said 25 years?
No, he actually served about 29.
Oh.
He was sentenced to 25 to life, but he served about 29. And the sad thing is, the Cathcart family wasn't told about that he was getting out until it was in the newspaper, because Annie's parents have both since passed away, and I guess they didn't know that she had a sister who's still alive. So they found out about that in the news, which was unfortunate.
Yeah. Now, have you heard anything from him or any reaction of the book or anything about
from the defendant?
Yeah.
No, I heard nothing from the defendant. I did get contacted by just before the book came out, I did an interview on a local radio station there, and I did get contacted by the husband of one of her cousins who was worried about it, asking me, you know, what tact everything was going to stay. And I told him, I said, if you want to set up a meeting with the family, and I'll talk to them, and I'll even give them a preview copy of the book so they can see it. And they'll see I treated Annie very nicely. I think I did a pretty good job, because I'd like to think so, of honoring her memory. And I did nothing to say anything bad about them. They never really followed up with that. I mean, the guy who called me knows me, and we have a respect for one another. He's actually currently a city alderman. I used to be a city alderman some years ago, state ward. So, you know, we know each other, we respect one another, so I think once I told him, I think he took my word on it. But, you know, I've gotten contacted on Facebook by some of her friends from high school days, and some of them were, you know, you better be good to her, and some of them were, I'm so grateful somebody's telling her story. You know, it varied with different things like that. But for the most part, everything I've gotten has been positive.
Yeah.
You know, I make it a point not to write intentionally write something salacious. I looked at before I researched the heck out of something before I write it to make sure, one, I can write something that I'll be proud of, and two, something that's going to be interesting that people are going to want to buy, because what's the point of writing a great book and everybody goes, eh, you know, so, you know, it takes a little bit of, you know, and this had everything it needed. I was doing the research, and I remember saying to my mother, my mother's a retired teacher, so she always does the initial editing when I write, because I get going on a roll, and I just want to, you know, so she likes to do that, it's fun, so, she's good at it, too, so.
Yeah.
Old school grammarian, you know.
Oh, well, that's so, good. That's great.
I wanted to make sure that if I couldn't have written in a way that would have presented Annie in a positive light, I wouldn't have written it. Because I wouldn't have wanted to put her, if the evidence showed that she was a drug addict or something, I wouldn't have written it because I wouldn't have wanted to put the family through anymore.
Yeah, I don't. I think it said something about the book as well. Like if it comes out and it's real, real kind of nasty and bad pictures and all that stuff, it kind of makes it trashy anyway, right? So
it does. And the other thing I drives me crazy is when you see a book come out about a famous crime, and of course now they've got this brand new suspect and so forth, and it makes big headlines and so forth. And you read it, and within 30 seconds you're going, "Oh no, this guy didn't do it."
Yeah. Yeah.
You see that with the Zodiac.
Yeah.
So a lot with the Lindbergh kidnapping. I can usually refute those in 30 seconds.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. It's endless. Yeah. I know. It's just, we deal with it all the time. And actually that book of yours looks really interesting. I didn't realize you'd written that book. I mean, I did, but I didn't click until now. So, that would be great to have you back talk about that, because we've done the Lindbergh case. I've only done it with the, profilers, John Douglas and Olshaker.
Oh yeah. They wrote a book where they talked about it. Their book was excellent.
Yeah, and that's kind
I
of
disagree
what I
with one or two things, but their book was a lot of fun to read. It was well written.
Yeah,
I have a lot of respect for both of them. They're good at what they do.
They're great. I love having them on the show, and I love their books, and it gives you good things to think about. At least it's well written. Yeah. It's good.
Oh, it's very well written, and I don't agree. I mean, I've heard him give some of his theories, and I don't agree with his theories, but people may understand, well, how can you disagree with his theories and still respect him? It's because he's good at what he does, and just because we don't come to the same conclusion doesn't mean I don't respect the man. You look at his career, what he's done, I don't know how you can't respect him. He's good at what he does.
Oh, yeah. I agree totally.
Well, do you have another book planned for us, or what's your next book coming out?
I don't know yet. I kind of need time to unwind from this one first, because it takes a lot of effort and time. I'm looking at a few things. There's another crime in Kingston I'm looking at. There's a crime from back in the 1830s in New York City that I'm looking at. I take a lot of time picking what I'm going to write about it because, as I said, you got to pick something. Just because a crime sounds interesting doesn't mean it's going to make a good book. So you have to take your time and go through it and pick the right one. We'll see. One of the ones I looked at for a long time, because I think it's such an interesting case, but it's a great example of a book that's interesting, of a case that's interesting but won't make a great book, is a famous case. You heard of the case of, they call him D.B. Cooper?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, that is a famous and a fascinating case where, the guy who basically holds up a plane and ends up diving out of the back of the plane. Again, and there's a lot of questions, did he survive or did he not? Well, the problem is, I can write about it and tell you all about it, but I don't know the solution. Nobody does. And it wouldn't be that good of a book because, I can get all this from all these other books. What are you telling me? Well, I'm telling you it's interesting, but I don't know. So it wouldn't be right. Unless you come up with a good solution that'll work, it's not, it's not going to be. You might sell a lot of books because a lot of those books that suggest somebody, even when they get refused, sell a lot.
Yeah.
Because making an accusation is sometimes more interesting and type of thing than it is to say, like in my book on the Lindbergh case, well, the guy who was accused and convicted, he did it. Well, that's dog bites man,
Yeah.
But so you'll sometimes sell more books with that. But I'm more concerned when people look at my books, they're going to say, okay, I can rely on this guy. You know, what he tells me is true, or what he believes strongly to be true. It's not some wild, like the old In Search of show, where they all do that on other
Yeah, no, it's good to have that reputation. I know sometimes it's hard if you have publishers, but Wild Blue's a great publisher. So
yeah, I have no complaints.
Yeah, no, Steve's good. Well, it's been very interesting. I've really enjoyed having you on the show. Our guest has been Richard Cahill, and the book is Sidetracked. Thank you for being on the show with us. Joining us now is Joe Yusinski, and he's going to be talking about Countdown of Conspiracies. Say, Joe, how are you doing?
Very good. Happy New Year to you and yours, and Happy New Year to all of our listeners. It's great to be back, and if 2017 was the year of conspiracy, I think 2018 will probably surpass it. So I've got our three for our first week of 2018, but before I wanted to do that, I wanted to share with you guys the result of a new poll that was taken in France in December, and the results just came out yesterday. So people like to think, oh, the United States is a bunch of conspiracy kooks. Well, what about those French? What do the French think about conspiracy theories? So how about I name the conspiracy theory? We'll make this fun. I'll name the conspiracy theory, and you guys tell me what percentage of French people believe in it, and we'll see if you can get it right.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Surprise. Okay.
Okay, so how many believe that JFK was killed by a conspiracy? Now, again, these aren't Americans. How many French people believe in the JFK assassination conspiracy?
Ooh. Oh, boy.
I'll say, go ahead, Al.
Oh, 30%.
I'm going to go 70.
Ooh.
Okay, we've got 30 and 70. The correct answer is we're going to split the difference. It's 54%.
Whoa.
So a majority of French people, and that's not actually far off from the American number, which holds at about 60 right now.
Oh.
Okay. So that's the mundane. Now let's get weird for a minute. So this isn't a big theory in our country explicitly, but it's a big one in Europe. It's called the replacement conspiracy theory. And that theory says that the governments are trying to get rid of white European people and replace them all with low-cost immigrant non-white workers. So what percentage of French people do you think believe in that conspiracy theory?
Oh boy, right now, since they're living it, oh, I'm going to stick with my original guess. I'm going to drop it to 40.
So 40?
No, it's closer to 60, 65. Yeah, 60.
Okay, 40 and 60. Okay, again, we're going to split the difference. 48% of French people believe in the replacement theory.
See, and that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah. If you were to put that in the U.S., you'd probably have, a much smaller number than that, maybe 15, 20%. But over there, where it's pretty salient.
Depends where you are. In Alabama, it's probably around 90.
Yeah, about 98.
Yeah, no, but that didn't surprise me because Le Pen won 30%, 35% of the vote. And I think 50, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's why I figured 60,
Huh. Okay, so here's one. How many French people do you think believe in flat Earth?
Oh,
wow.
10%.
Oh.
Okay, is that the answer for both?
That's for
no.
Me.
That's Al's guess. Flat earthers. Okay. I mean, it's making a comeback. 25.
Okay, 10 and 25. Al's correct. Yeah. 10%.
Oh.
Right on the head.
Oh, I win the prize. Woohoo.
I'll give you the rundown of the rest of these. About 32% believe that AIDS is a conspiracy theory. 31% think that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations were created by Western security agencies like the CIA. 16% buy into the moon landings, and that's actually higher than it is here in the U.S. In the U.S., it's about 6. And a majority of French people, 55%, think that pharmaceutical companies and the government are hiding the true dangers of vaccines. So that's actually probably double what it is in the U.S.
Wow. I wonder why they're on so much. So they seem to be more on edge than America. I'm surprised by that a little bit.
Given recent events, it doesn't actually shock me. The 10% for the flat earth thing does. That's a little bit disturbing. but I've seen polls in this country where you get 6% for the lizard people. So,
yeah, well, you mean it's not true?
Well, for 94%, it's not. For the other 6, they're living in, you know, V.
Oh,
hey, that was based on a true story.
Yeah, that's it. In Alabama again. It has to be.
They keep killing my cattle.
Oh, you're going to have to go to the pharmacy soon for that. Yeah. Okay. So now, what's the big conspiracy going on right now, or is there?
Okay. So we've got our top three, and number three for this week takes place in my home state of Florida. And this is based on a video that's currently posted on YouTube, and you can find it. And it has a Google satellite image of an aerospace company that's located out in the Florida swamp. And supposedly it has an alien diamond-shaped stealth spacecraft. And they think that this is actually an alien craft that may have been captured. And they're keeping it here in a Florida swamp. So, but it's you can actually find the video on YouTube, and it shows you a nice overhead view of the spacecraft. Now, I don't know if it's a spacecraft or not, and because it's sitting on the ground, you know, you can't even actually tell if it can fly or if it's just a fancy car. But if we make these assumptions, it does look like, if we saw it in the sky, we would probably classify it as an unidentified flying object. So,
well, but why would they be keeping it in a swamp?
Well, from what I can tell is that this is an aerospace company that they have out there. So they build this technology out there on cheap land. And probably to stay away from prying eyes. So I guess if you're going to keep an alien spacecraft somewhere, you won't do it out in the city. You would do it out, obviously in the sticks.
Wow. Well, I mean, if I was going to hide a spaceship, I'd leave it in Alabama.
I would just put it in my garage.
In a barn.
In a barn.
Yeah, in the drive-thru.
So that's our number three. And Florida has a lot of this weird stuff going on. So, we were the first state with a zombie attack that happened a couple of years ago. So having an alien spacecraft isn't out of the ordinary for us. So number two has to do with Apple and our iPhones. And there are two things going on here. And if you're Apple users, you probably already heard about this. But there's been a conspiracy theory for a long time that Apple has been throttling the phones. So if you have an older model iPhone, that they've been purposely making it slower so that you have to go buy the new model. And there's a adjacent conspiracy theory that says that they're making the older phones obsolete so that they just break and then you have to go buy the new phone. Now, Apple has said that, no, this isn't true, and there's actually quite a few court cases about this. But they're saying that, yes, they do slow the phones down, but it's only, for security reasons and to make sure that the phones run well and don't crash.
Yeah.
So that's our number two for the week.
I think that they do it, but people jump into new phones every year without any, with no hesitation. They're always getting the newest and the latest. I don't know.
Like, if I meet somebody who has a flip phone, I won't even talk to them.
Right. Oh, you better hang up there, Kevin. He's, he's on his flip phone. Well, it just doesn't make sense because everybody's always, every time there's a new phone, doesn't matter if they're using Samsung or iPhone, people are just jumping up all the time. I don't know that they need it to do that to get new phones, but whatever, you know.
You got to admit it, it's kind of compelling because every time, if it seems that every phone that I buy will last 2 years, then as soon as as soon as you're done paying for it, boom, it's done.
Yeah.
And it just happens to be the next model has come out.
Yeah, it could be, but it's. I still think for the most part people want to get the new model. They can't wait for a new one, and they just keep jumping out. And it never costs you anything, just a new contract.
I mean, if you think about it this way, like with cars, people want to go buy a car that's going to last a long time, right?
Yeah.
But, with an iPhone, it's exactly what you say. It's like, I want it to last, and most people, they wouldn't even update every year. Unless they had to wait. They'd want the new one every 6 months. So no one goes buying a phone saying, hey, I hope this will last me a decade.
Yeah.
The way they do with a car. So.
Yeah, it's true.
And so our number one for the week gets a little bit weird, and that is that OJ is actually Khloe Kardashian's secret father.
Oh, wow.
So the conspiracy theory says neither Bruce Jenner nor her father, Kardashian, but actually OJ, who was, the father's attorney during the trial. Now, OJ has come out and denied this, and he said that's not the case, that he was never with their mother and couldn't be Khloe's father.
Oh.
But with that said, people are speculating, and this is quite a juicy one. No pun intended.
it's OJ's love child.
Yeah, and now he'll write a book about it. I'm not her father, but if I was, here's how I'd do it.
Ooh, there we go.
Now, what are they basing this on?
Well, there's always been some questions about her heritage in different tabloids, and this one just sort of popped up. I had never seen this before. But if you were to connect people, we know that the father was connected with OJ because he was his attorney during the trial, or one of the attorneys during the trial.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
So, but it can't feel good if you're her and people are saying, "Hey, we think your dad is O.J. Simpson," and be like, "Hey, I think your dad is Charles Manson." It's not.
I don't know. That'd be a cool thing today. I don't think she could feel anything anyway with all that filler.
Yeah.
So, and if we get hate mail for that, that's okay. That's okay. That I'll laugh at. Wow, that's something to think about now. I'm going to think about that all week.
Well, we are starting the year off strong, so I expect the next 51 weeks to have even better material for us. So.
Well, I like that. I'm glad that it's good to hear one about OJ and kind of like, I don't know what kind of star to call her. She's not really a movie star or a singer.
Yeah, what have they done?
I'm just trying. That's why I was trying to call her something, and I didn't know what to call her.
Except just be crazy. Like, I mean, if I was Bruce, I'd come out a little.
Well, I'm in transition too.
If I deliver the Kardashians.
Yeah, I'd switch too. Oh my. Well, that does it for the day. Well, thank you, Joe. That's always good to hear.
Well, thank you guys. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.